Now, once again, here's Mark.
Well, good morning, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock, broadcasting from 85541, which is up north in Payson this weekend. And I'm here all by myself, and the spring is here. I'm telling you, spring is here. All the trees are blossoming. The pollen is knee-deep. And lots of animals. So if you're thinking about coming up here and hiding, then you can. It was 31 degrees at my place this morning. I'm typically a little colder than what they report Payson is. But it makes no difference because it's a beautiful day today. Anyways, that's from the Chamber of Commerce for Payson. Action Auto Repairs at I-17 in Deer Valley, and I've known Tom since 1983. Tom and his staff, they're well known for really good quality workmanship, excellent customer service, and a fast turnaround time. And I like that part because some of us don't always do that all the time. We have a tough time saying no at the front counter, so we take in more cars than our shop can process. Tom can handle that. He's got ASE Master Certified Technicians, which means these are like PhD kind of guys in the auto repair industry, a master tech. I'm a master tech and have been since 1991, and you must certify every 5 years until you get to retirement age, and then you become a retired ASE Master Certified Technician. So, Action Auto Repair, I-17 in Deer Valley, great place. If you don't have a shop and you live in that area, may I suggest that you go there. We've got two callers, and by the way, you're welcome to join in anytime you want. All you have to do is call the number 602-508-0960, and Gil will say, good morning, what's your name, and you want to talk to Mark, and you say yes, and give me your name, or give me your brother's name, no one cares, and then he whispers in my ears that Bob is your first caller. So Bob and Ken's number two. Bob, how are you? What can we do for you?
Well, I don't know. It's too early to tell, but I have a couple questions. Number one, the 2000 Dodge Ram 4x4, to try to find one in Arizona is next to impossible. The few people that got them or whatever, they want unbelievable amounts of money for them. So I had to work with a used car dealership, and we got one from Virginia. We had to truck it in here. I'm being told when I checked it out, the brake light was on, okay, when it arrived here. Now, I'm being told by the dealership that's got it that it could be a sensor. The brakes are okay, but it could be a sensor. Does that make sense to you, or could it be something else?
What color is the brake light?
It's red.
Okay. I've been wrong before, but that doesn't even make any sense at all. Red means stop. That means we have a major malfunction. That's why everything on your dashboard that's red is red, and then we have a bunch of yellow stuff like check engine lights and stuff. So I don't agree with that at all. I think red means that we have uneven pressure somewhere in the system. So when we apply the brakes, we're supposed to send about 60% of the pressure to the front, 40% to the back, and then we cycle that. There's solenoids there that open and close and dump the pressure to control the ABS. And so we have all this going on. And there's no way in God's green earth do I believe for a second that this is a sensor. And then the next question is where is the sensor, Mr. Technician or Mr. Service Writer? How much is it? And are you going to guarantee that this is the only dollars I'm going to spend to turn that light off? Now, here's the problem I can't diagnose your truck over the phone. You know that.
Okay. Well, I'm in the Sunny Slope area. What they're doing, they're saying that it's a sensor. Of course, I don't know because I'm not a mechanic. They're saying it's the sensor, and they said they're going to knock off $500 to $800 off of the price. Okay, but I feel uncomfortable about that. But, you know, it is what it is. Trying to find an 01 Dodge Ram 4x4 at an affordable price, good luck, because nobody wants to sell them. It is what it is. So if you lived in a Sunny Slope area and you wanted someone to check this out that really knows what they're doing, could you recommend somebody for me? Sunny Slope.
Here's the problem you got. The problem isn't the shop. The problem is this could turn into be something really big that no one finds out till 30 days from now. And if we can turn off that light all you want, you can bring it into any shop in town and we'll turn the light off. It's going to come right back on. The real problem you got is if they do whatever they're going to do, the magic wand they're going to do, they need to warranty that. So you need to get them to stand up and say, we'll take care of this. The light comes back on and we have the same problem, we'll take care of it. If the light comes back on and it's something else, we'll take care of it. Our diagnosis is right. That's the problem. You can tell that this really make, not you, this, our industry makes this mad. And part of the problem you have is you got a technician that's talking to the dispatcher who talks maybe to the service manager, and then he talks to the young man or woman in the service drive, and they're talking to you. And you are a long way away from the dude that checked this out.
So what you're saying, Mark, is that I need to ask them to get that light to go off, and if it comes back on, I need to have them warranty it?
I'm telling you, and I'm not telling you to do anything. I'm telling you this is the recipe for disaster, because I've never fixed a car or a truck, any car, with a red brake light with a sensor in one of the wheels. That's an ABS problem, and that's going to be a yellow light. So the sensors on the wheels give the speed of the wheel to the computer. When we lose sight of one of the wheels, the ABS light comes on, traction control light may come on. They're both yellow, and that's it. That's a sensor. So I can't coach you through this. You can argue with me all you want. You either get it out of there and take it someplace else and have them diagnose it. I don't know how you're going to get them to promise about the future. I'm telling you the diagnosis doesn't match the repair. That's all.
Okay, well, no, to come to think of it, I can't remember if the light was yellow or red. I really can't.
Okay, that makes a big difference.
A sensor, for them saying it's a sensor that makes the light come on, you say there's something is wrong about that diagnosis?
It doesn't match the red part. Now you don't know color the light is. That makes a big difference.
Yeah,
a yellow light is caution. Continue to drive. The truck is going to be okay. It's safe. I see a problem. That's a yellow light. A red light says, stop your butt now. There's a big difference between those two lights.
Can you recommend a mechanic in the East Sunny Soap area that I could take this to?
Where is it at now?
It's actually at Cave Creek Road in Hatcher in East Sunny Soap.
Is that a dealership?
Well, it's a used car dealership.
Oh. Okay. Go to MarkSalem.com, MarkSalem.com, and look at the best car repair shop list.
MarkSalem.com.
Yeah.
Okay, one more last question. What do you think of battery disconnects? I know the 01 Dodge Ram, people want them. There's very few of them around. I don't know why. It is what it is. But a battery disconnect, I've had one before, and I had not. I mean, it was good, okay? But would you say that is one way to slow down somebody if they want to steal a truck like that, just get the battery disconnect?
Wow, man, the boogeyman lives in your head, doesn't it?
I
can steal any car, and I can go all the way around whatever you decide to do. Because I'm going to crawl underneath there, cut the hood cable, grab a pair of pliers, pop the hood open. I'm going to close your battery disconnect switch, and if it's inside the car, I'm just going to jump the solenoid. I mean, the car thieves aren't that stupid. If you want to keep it from the car, if you're worried about it getting stolen, and frankly, I don't know why. I don't know that's not going to keep me up awake, and I have plenty of Dodges. Then go down and have some stereo system put an alarm system in it. So when the door opens, the alarm goes off. When the hood opens, the alarm goes off. That kind of stuff. And do that. Or, better yet, you can have somebody hide a particular switch somewhere in the car, and it disables the car's ability to drive or start. So we can, you know, there's a lot of us old guys that can do that and just put a hidden switch somewhere under the car that you have to remember to turn on and turn off as you get in and out of the car. But, yes, you're right. The Dodge trucks are few and far between. I'm not quite sure why you're so hung up on a 00 or 01.
An 01 is the last year they made that body style.
Okay. Okay.
And right. I've been, you know, it's, I mean, believe me, I've been looking all over the country, and the ones in Arizona, the people that have them, they just don't want to sell them. And if they do, if it's in good shape, you're talking $30,000, $40,000.
Okay. I understand the situation, so it's not necessary for you to tell me and tell all of us that used cars and trucks right now are at a premium. Everybody's having trouble finding something that they want. But I'm not quite sure an 01 just makes my heart happy. I would think you'd go newer than that, but it could be a price range issue, and you want to be in this price range or whatever. I don't know. But I don't know why you'd pick a truck for a body style when the body style changes are so insignificant from year to year that they're not recallable. They're not something that's going to add or subtract to the value of the vehicle. So I'm not quite sure why body styles. I mean, we're talking body styles through the Fords and the Dodges and the Chevys and Isuzus and everybody else. So, but I got to run. Ken, you're up next. How can I help you, Ken?
Hello, Mark. I have a problem with my truck I've been dealing with for 3 or 4 years, and nobody can fix it. I get a false overheat.
Okay, let's start. Let me ask some questions. Why don't you tell me what kind of truck it is?
Okay, it's a 2003 F-250, a V10, 6.8 V10.
And tell me what you mean when you say it's a false overheat.
Well, the temperature gauge will sit around half, and then all of a sudden it'll go completely hot, and the truck will go into limp mode, like it's overheating.
1 minute.
But if I turn it off and then turn it right back on, the temperature gauge will go back to half, and it's fine. I can drive it for a while, and then it will do that intermittently. I can't predict when it will happen. And it's not overheating. I've had the radiator replaced.
Oh, No, this is question and answer time. This is not historical time. I don't care what you've had done. Has anybody replaced the coolant sensor?
I've had the...
No, it's a yes or a no. It's a yes or a no. The coolant sensor and the temp sensor are two different items, but... I would be replacing the coolant sensor and look at the harness. That's what I'd be looking at. We do have problems with the harness on a lot of cars at the coolant sensor because of the temperature swings it's got. And the cool, if you short those two out, then we're probably going to show an overheat and we're going to go into limp mode. So, I don't know about rodding the radiator and all that. I would have never done any of that. It's an electrical issue, and the computer is getting a hot signal, and it's saying that the motor is in toast mode, and so it goes into limp mode. The question is what's telling the computer it's in toast mode? That's it. And really and truly, the only thing that can tell it that is the coolant sensor. It's right up near the thermostat housing. And so, if I were you, I'd look at the wires to make sure they're not chafed, that they haven't been chewed. I would make sure that the wire and the plug is in good shape. Otherwise, cut it off and go get another one at Ford. And I'd put a new coolant sensor on there. And I sure as hell wouldn't worry about looking at a coolant sensor that comes in a Ford box. Because there's only a couple companies that make them. And in reality, I'd just go buy the cheapest one I can find. Because if you open the box on it and you open the box on something that says Ford or gold plated, it's all going to be the same sensor. So that I would do that.
And you think it could be the cluster bad, right?
Well,
wiring cluster.
You mean
the gauge cluster.
Well, why is it that the gauge cluster just tells you what it's told to tell you?
Right.
How is it that the gauge cluster is going to cause the problem?
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
This is what people have told me.
I know.
It's possible.
I know, but they haven't been working on cars since 1968 either. All I'm saying to you is I don't want to argue with people who have talked to you. I want to tell you the cluster is a reporting device. So to have somebody go in and replace the cluster is at best a wild ASS guess. That's all. And it just reports. So the compute, there's nothing going back out of the sensors that go. The coolant sensor talks to the PCM. The PCM talks to the dashboard. So, anyway, I've given you the best advice I can give you, and I feel like I'm about 85% sure that that's where your problem lies, is at the coolant sensor. But anyway, I got to run. But good luck to you, Ken. Thank you, 602-508-0960. Welcome back, everybody. 21 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. This is what works best for the show and you, but for you. Is your make and model and what the problem is, what the symptom is. I'm not interested in what you did before because none of that worked. I mean, let's be honest. Why were you going to spend a lot of time talking about what you did when the problem is still there? But nevertheless, a lot of the questions I have, it answers are yes or no or I don't know. Those are three acceptable answers because this is a give and take kind of show. So you say, this is what I got. I ask questions. You answer the questions. And again, yes, no, or I don't know. Automatic Transmission Exchanges in Phoenix has been around on 40th Street in Washington since 1968. When you grow up rebuilding transmissions from manuals to automatics and you go from the three speeds in the 60s and the 70s all the way to the eight speeds in the 2022, the fundamentals of how we shift it don't change. It just changes on how we shift it. Do we shift it with water, air, or fluid, or electronics? So there's lots of different things like that. But when it comes to transmissions, the king of the town, as far as I'm concerned, is Automatic Transmission Exchange. Dave, good morning. How can I help you?
Good morning. Simple question, I believe. I have a 2013 Toyota Tundra, Rock Warrior package. And it's an automatic transmission fluid question.
Okay.
I started changing at 60,000 miles. They recommend do not change your, completely change all of the transmission fluid. I don't know why that is, or I've done it myself and changed a gallon at a time is basically all that comes out of the pan and replace that. Is that a good system to keep going with? Or is it better to replace it all?
Well, who's they? They said.
That would be me.
Okay.
Oh, they pick, you name it.
Okay.
Not the dealer. I've looked in my manual. I've looked at what it says.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to change your question.
Dealer do it.
I'm going to change your question.
Sure, okay,
Mark, what do you do to your cars? I think we have a fleet of 30 vehicles. Many of them are company vehicles. But what do you do on your cars? Yes, if you want to, you can do a half service. We usually do transmissions at 100,000s, somewhere around in there. But at the 50 mark, at the 60 mark, you could drain the pan and do the filter and be done with it. That's certainly acceptable.
Okay.
At 100, I'd leave the filter in there, leave the pan on there, and I'd flush it. And we're going to disconnect the cooler lines that come from the transmission. We're going to reconnect those to our fancy-dancy piece of equipment. And we're going to flush out all your old stuff and put new stuff in, and we're done. We're not going to open the pan, and we're not going to change the filter because you did it at 50 or 60. And so you can
right.
hopscotch your way through life that way. If you, I don't know why. I think, of course, in reality, your Tundra's 9 years old, so I'm trying to figure out and in my head on the newer model cars and stuff. It really wouldn't hurt you with today's synthetic transmission fluids and stuff. It really wouldn't hurt you just to service it at 100,000. Now, that means pull the pan, change the filter, then flush it. And now we're talking $300.
Okay.
And okay. So, and a lot of us will do it however our customers want it. When the old gray-haired guys, which I am one, come in, it's kind of like just feeling them out a little bit. What do you want it, and where's your comfort zone? And at 100, I don't want to pull the pan and just put a filter in it because that fluid's been around the world four times. So I kind of want to do all the filters. So why don't we leave your filter in there because you did it, and let's just flush it. And our machines are pretty sufficient. Pretty successful in flushing them. Consider this. I'm pushing coolant in, red fluid in, and then I have a clear line on the return back to the machine. So if I'm pushing in cherry red soda pop and I'm bringing out chocolate milk, I'm going to keep flushing until both lines are cherry. That's what it all boils down to.
Okay.
Okay?
One last question.
Sure.
Does this hold any weight? Other things I've read, if you flush the whole system, it will release deposits that are there that you don't want to have released. And if you do completely new transmission fluid, that would release those deposits. It would cleanse it too well, per se.
Okay.
Is there any truth to that?
That's written by some idiot who wants to sell a whole bunch of transmission fluids. Let me explain. I'm talking to the idiot, okay? I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the idiot. So
right,
let me get this straight.
Yeah, for sure.
The suck part of the transmission is connected to the filter, and the filter sitting in the bottom of the pan, and the bottom of the pan is where all the trash is at. But the reason why we have the filter there is because if we suck fluid in, then the filter stops the trash, and so we get good fluid all the way through the system into the torque converter and then back out into the pan. So this circle of fluid, you're telling me that if I use new fluid, then all the trash inside there is going to go where? Where's it going to go?
Gotcha.
And the problem with this is we have shops that this is their mantra. This is, they look you in the eye and they've all been trading the same thing, and you can't argue with them because they don't have the other side of the argument. Plus you're thinking to yourself, that's like your oil in your engine. You know what I mean? All the trash that's in the oil pan of your engine would just sicken you, but it ain't going through the filter. It's okay. It's okay. Now, a lot of it's going to settle in the bottom of the pan. And when we pull the pan off, we're going to find small pieces of metal, flakes. Let me call them flakes. Flakes of metal. We're going to find some trash. We're going to find a little bit of carbon. We're going to find some clutch material. No one cares.
No one cares.
There's no measurement. So there's no one in the world that looks at it and says, oh, boy, this transmission is 10,000 miles from just going to heaven. Nobody can do that. So gotcha. A lot of what you talk about is the chatter on YouTube, but when you go back, you find out that the guy that's chattering this is in a federal penitentiary in Idaho, and he did things to children that he shouldn't have, and he's now an expert, and everybody's following him because he's telling everybody how to handle their transmissions. And so you made me laugh, and I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Okay. I'm glad I could do it. Okay. Have a good day.
Okay. Hey, Edward, it's not going to serve right. We're going to start with just your question because I got 2 minutes, but I'm going to hold you over to the break so you and I can talk. So tell me what you got.
We got a 2012 Yamaha Super Tenere motorcycle, and I've got a question about when you, a month ago or so, were talking to someone with a car that required ethyl gasoline, you told him, if I remember right, that the computer will compensate for using regular. Would that be true for the system in my Yamaha, which also has fuel injection and electronic ignition and all the bells and whistles?
If you have an oxygen sensor, then you apply. You're okay. And I'm pretty sure with fuel injection, you have an oxygen sensor that tells the computer what the heck's going on. And the computer is watching the throttle, and it's watching the RPM. And so the computer knows that at idle, I'm going to squirt like this. Tss, tss, tss. And when he's wide open throttle and he's drag racing the guy next door to him, then I'm going to go. Pss, and when I come back, I'll finish this conversation with you. But I understand what you're talking about. Meanwhile, we have open line 602-508-0960. There's four lines. 602-508-0960. Got a car question or an argument? I can handle it. Welcome back, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour. We're going to talk to Edward, and then I'm going to talk about auto dynamics. But, Edward, on your motorcycle, we were talking about the difference in gasoline between regular and super, right?
Yes.
Okay. I want to tell you a funny story that's the truth. There was a time when someone said that they could tell the difference between regular and super. And so I was a part of a group that put together this test. And so, and it was a computerized car that has a NOx sensor and has fuel controls, and it gives it more fuel when it's cold and hot. And we came up with some parameters where we were going to have the driver, who swears he could tell the difference, do it. So after we did all of our magic, then he drove it, then we did some more magic, and then we drove it, then did some more magic, and then we drove it. He drove it. And he comes back and he goes, the first one was the same as the second one, and the third one, you put something different in the tank. And we all start smiling because we hadn't done anything to it at all. And it's been that way all my life. I've never met anybody who consistently can tell whether I put regular or super. But here is the science of it. In an exaggerated format so that it's easy to visualize, one molecule in regular gasoline, one ignites two. Two ignite 2 million, and 2 million ignite 2 trillion. So it's kind of like a balloon that's popped. So you have a balloon in your hand, and you have a needle, and you go, boom, that's it. Super, in an exaggerated way, or supreme, ethyl, one molecule ignites 5, 5 ignite 10, 10 ignite 20, 20 ignite 30. So the burn is slower. So instead of just boom, it's kind of a boom. We're talking milliseconds.
In model airplane diesels, we have something called a cetane booster that seemingly does about the same thing. Amyl nitrite or amyl nitrate for model airplane diesels.
Yes, 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 cetane, yes. And it's supposed to do the same thing for diesel vehicles where one molecule, it's just a slower flame front, they call it. We usually fire from one side of the cylinder head or the other, from the left side to the right or the right side to the left or whatever. And picture a flame that goes, a forest fire. And so you're looking at the fire and it starts on your left, and then all of a sudden, if it just burns slowly all the way across the horizon, that's premium. But if it starts here and all of a sudden there's an explosion and the whole horizon lights up, then that's regular. So I want to tell you something. Historically, in testing that I've been involved in, no one has been able to tell the difference other than just simple guessing. And that's why I'm going to be a part of a test, or in historically have been willing to be a part of a test as long as we have 3, 4, 5 examples to give somebody, especially an odd number, so that they have to hang their hat on one or the other. But I have a twin turboed Corvette, a Z06 Corvette. I only run premium in it because the motor is so doggone expensive. I was told by my son that one of my daughter-in-laws put regular in it, and when he drove it, Dad, it rattled on me. But I also know his foot is really heavy. So I said, what'd you do? And he goes, I just diluted it with some more premium, and it went away. But then I said to him, well, what about, when was the circumstances when it rattled? And he goes, well, he says, I was going clear up north to Flagstaff to drop off my wife at her mother's house. And he says, and so it was going up those hills, and I'm thinking, okay, the car's hot. It's a hot day. The engine temperature's up high, and it rattled a little bit. And so then when he got to Flagstaff, he filled it with premium, and he came back home, and he said it wasn't there. We're talking about two stretches of highway that aren't the same. One of them's uphill from the hot to the cooler, and one of them's downhill from the cooler to the hot. And so I just, from my opinion, most people can't tell, and if you can't tell, there's no reason to spend the money. So the next question is of all the vehicles that I own, how many do I put premium gasoline in, and it's the only one is that Corvette, and it's just because it's a twin turboed 6-liter, and it's a very expensive motor, and I don't want to take the chance. Does that make sense?
Well, I think I heard something about that Corvette before, and I can understand your respect for the cost of things, because I respect the cost of things.
Yeah.
But with mine, it's supposed to also have a switch from sport to touring, where I do get substantially more power in the sport switch mode in my whatever the electronic magic is inside.
And I can do that with a toggle switch on just about any electronic car by taking the coolant sensor and feeding a signal different. For instance, the coolant sensor says that the coolant is 220 degrees. Okay? And everything is fine there. But if I tell the computer that the coolant says that the coolant's really cold, it's going to enrichen the mixture, add more fuel to the engine to make it warm up faster. Are you getting me? So if you want it to run richer, you change the coolant sensor signal to cold and not to hot. So there are a variety of ways that you can mess with the computer and feed it information to make it turn on the faucet all the way under the appropriate appropriate circumstances. When your foot's on the floor and somebody's next door and you're on your way down I-10 and there's no one else on the road and it's 3:00 in the morning and you're only going to race for like 2 seconds.
Oh, this is a rocket ship. It's way more power than I need. If I'd had one of these when I was a kid, I'd have killed myself.
And you and I are...
It's a whole different thing than anything I need. The other question related to that is back when I had an ancient Datsun, it had an adjustable ignition timing thing, and if I had a crummy gas in there, was running full throttle, it would ping, and I could hit the pre-ignition detonation kind of problem. Is that something that's going to be audible on a motorcycle if it is detonating?
No. You won't hear it. It's going to be very, very difficult to hear it. very difficult to hear just because of the noise, because of the wind, because your helmet's on your head, because your ears are sitting in holes inside your head. It'll be very, very difficult to hear. But if it's tuned right and it has the right spark plug in it, then you want to use regular unleaded gas, then I think what's really going to harm you is it's the wide open throttle, shift 2, wide open throttle, shift 3, shift 4, shift 5, wide open throttle throughout that entire range. That's where you're going to pop the motor by being stupid, if it's going to happen.
That was over 140 miles an hour last time I went crazy.
Okay. All right. Well, I won't ask you for your name, address, and phone number for the policemen that are going to knock on your door in the near future. Okay.
Okay. Thank you for such a great show. I sure appreciate it across the years. The other question I had is I can't physically work on my bike anymore. I used to do a lot of stuff on the old school bikes, but anymore I'm just not strong to get up and down and back and forth. And I'm wondering, is there a shop you could recommend in North Central Phoenix for a valve adjustment?
I'm going to have you send me an email, mark@marksalem.com, mark@marksalem.com, and I will have an answer for you on Monday or Tuesday. I need to call a couple of shops and their old motorcycle guys. Hey, do you want to do a valve adjustment on a 12 Honda? Now, what's the model number of the Yamaha Watt?
It's called a Super Tenere.
Super?
It's their 1200 parallel twin dual sport bike with all the electronics in it.
Okay. And it's so dual sport means on and off road. I know a couple of guys that ride those on a regular basis, so I'm going to call them too, but you send me an email so we can communicate that way, okay?
Thank you very much, Mark.
You bet. We're going to take a break, then we'll be back right after this. So when it comes to car repair, Auto Dynamics is the only shop in Sun City that I can recommend. Folks, there's probably lots of good shops, but for me to recommend them, I have to do a lot of work with respect to their history and knowing the owner and knowing, you know, kind of what their market is and how long they've been in business. And I look at their Google complaints, and people can look at mine too. All that kind of stuff goes on, but Sun City's a tough place, but Auto Dynamics fits the bill just fine. So they're on the north side of Grand, just west of 99th Avenue, a place that, and I've known Chuck, the owner, since 1968. So it's been a long time. He does a good work, and so does his staff. Let's go back to the phones. David, thank you for holding. How can I help you?
Good morning, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm good. Good. Thank you.
I've got a couple questions. One is a car question, and one is a compliment to a shop.
Okay.
My car question is, I have a 77 Chevelle, and I don't know if I'm having a fuel sending unit issue. One day I was driving it, and it was down to about a half a tank, and I come to a stop, and then all of a sudden the gauge just goes all the way to full. And it just stayed there, and it wouldn't move back. And ever since then, it's just been hovering on a half a tank. And so I got underneath the tank and kind of started pounding on it, and it feels like it's almost empty or close to empty, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, one of the things that we would do as an industry is the first thing we're going to do is we're going to follow the wiring harness from the top of the tank all the way to where it goes through the firewall. And we're going to make sure that we don't have any wires that are broken or sitting close to or on the exhaust, because that's what happens sometimes. So when we ground one side or the other of the wire signal, then we usually go either full hot or full cold, or full or empty. So the extremes on the gauges. The other thing you can do is go in and fill it up and see if the gauge moves. If it doesn't move, then clearly you have a sending unit problem. And now you've got a problem because the tank is full, and nobody wants to change the sending unit when you bring it in with the tank full. So you're going to have to drive it down to about a quarter of a tank to take it in. And most of us will be happy to embrace to pull that tank for you and replace the sending unit. And we're not going to have a problem finding one either.
Okay.
But if you, right. I think you exercise it, I think you exercise the sending unit by filling it up and then just kind of keep track of your miles and so forth. And then you know that if you have a 16-gallon tank or an 18-gallon tank. So think, get to where you think you're at a half tank, then fill it back up again. And if you are at a half a tank and the gauge didn't move, then either the gauge or the sender's bad. We go back to the sender, find the right wire, ground it, the gauge will go to an extreme full, let go, the gauge goes to empty. So we know the gauge can see the parameters, we know the sender's bad. That's part of the checkout.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
All right.
My other question is, I called, one day I called Phoenix Body Work.
Okay.
And I heard that Greg had sold the business. And I don't know if that's true or not, or if you still have Phoenix Body Work on your list of shops.
I don't.
But I'd like to, you know, okay. I would just like to thank Greg. I took my car down to him, and I had some transmission work done at with Alger, and I need to bring my car to you, but I have to walk in June. And he goes, well, hold on, I'll give you a bottle of water, and I'll run you over to Alger's shop, and you can bring the car over to my shop. And I said, well, thank you very much. And you know, he did compliment LG. He said he was a really nice guy and he does really good work, and Greg has really done some work on our cars prior with repairs too. Okay. So I just like to, you know, thank all everything he's done.
Okay. I'm going to cut this out because I noticed I taped the whole show anyway, and I'll send it to Greg. But Greg's retired. He did sell his shop. The shop is no longer on my list because it's part of a group of shops. And historically, that doesn't work for me. So if you give one shop certification that's on the best Mark Salem's Best Car Repair Shops, now all of a sudden you got six shops that are bragging about being on Mark Salem's Best Car Repair Shop. So it doesn't work. Let me comment real quick about Alger. Alger started to work for me when he was 16 years old. He started working at the Ahwatukee Mobile in Ahwatukee, and I was the manager of the mobile station. Alger was into transmissions early. He is one of two guys in this valley that know so much about transmissions. Him and he is just an amazing person. He's the worst businessman in the world because he doesn't know how to say no. He's the worst businessman in the world because he misses all of his time frames. But he builds old and new alike. So he is a very good shop. The name of the shop is A&S Transmissions. Then it stands for Alger and Shelley, A&S, or it stands for Automatic and Standards. He'll never tell anybody. But I got to run. Blaine, you're up next. How can I help you, Blaine?
Yeah. Good morning. Hey, I've got a 1999 GMC Safari, 126,000 miles. The engine light did not come on, and the motor mounts have been replaced. My problem is I can feel the transmission shifting gear around 40, 42 miles an hour. And yesterday at this speed, the shifting was very rough, like I suddenly hit a lot of pot marks in the road.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I slowed down and come home because I didn't want to be towed in.
Okay. So, you got somebody that you can trust to do something inside the car and not kill you if you're laying next to it?
Alger. No. Can't do that. No. I just heard you talk about Alger. That's why I said that.
Here's what I would do, and I think all the old this is pretty universal. We're going to get in your Safari, and we're going to crawl underneath the front of it, and we're going to trust the driver. One of our guys is the driver. He's going to put his foot firmly on the brake. He's going to put it in drive, and he's going to kind of go rappa, rappa, and it should lift that the driver's side mount up and down, up and down. We're going to check to see if it's broken. Then I'm going to
the motor mounts have been replaced.
Okay. Then I'm going to do the same thing on the passenger side, and I'm going to look at the reverse. So I'm going to look at the reverse because it's going to lift up and go down. Then I'm going to go to the tranny mount, and I'm going to put it in drive and hold my foot on the brake, and I'm going to throttle it up pretty hard, and I'm going to see if that back tranny mount's intact. That's how we do it. So a good keen eye can figure that out. Who does your oil changes?
Oh, God, I only drive 1,000 miles a year.
Okay.
Wilhelm.
Okay.
Local guy. Okay.
If you, and another thing, too, is when you feel this transmission vibration that's being transmitted through the car. The real question is what do you do to stop it? Do you go from neutral to drive, or do you go from neutral to reverse, or do you go from drive to reverse, or reverse to drive? If you can answer that question, if you can make it go away by moving the shifter around, and you've already replaced the two engine mounts, then it has to be a rear mount. It has to be the tranny tail shaft mount. It has to be. So, okay. It's and then you have a floor jack at home, maybe?
I'm going on 89. I don't do any of this.
Okay. Well, how about your wife? Can't she crawl underneath there with a floor jack? I'm teasing you. Most of us would put a floor jack underneath there and just crawl underneath there, and just one of our buddies would jack it up a little bit, and then if the back of the tranny separates from the mount, it's broken.
Okay. You used to refer me to a shop on Thunderbird about 85th Avenue. Is she still on your list?
That was Tom Fletcher's Thunderbird Auto. When he sold, my endorsement doesn't transfer, but I can tell you this much. I can tell you that oftentimes I do have complaints after the fact, and it sold, and I've never had a complaint on that shop. Never. Never. And so I think that says a lot for the shop. But there's also Harkers at 38th Avenue and Indian School that wouldn't have any problem with this either, depending on where you live. But yes, that one out there that used to be Tom Fletcher's is a good shop at this particular point.
Do you have his phone number? Because I don't have one of these phones that gives the phone numbers out. The telephone numbers are all wrong in the book.
As far as Tom or the shop?
No, the shop. I'll take the shop over there.
Okay, can I offer you this? Would you email me your...
I don't have that.
Okay. Okay, then. Okay. Oh, wait. I got plan B. Can you write down a phone number?
Got it.
Okay. You're going to call 480-598-1234. You're going to ask for my daughter, Andy.
Okay.
And you're going to give her some way to get a hold of me, that I can get a hold of you. Okay? Some way.
Okay.
And if you want to give her, and I promise not to give it to anybody else, but I'll call Tom Monday morning, and then I'll find out the name of the shop. I'll get all the information. Andy's going to call me and say, hey, Blaine called and left this information, and then I'm going to call you at home, and I'm going to tell you.
Okay, I'll have a plan B, too.
Okay.
I'll have my daughter drive me over there, and I find out where he's at.
Okay, I'll help you either way, okay?
Okay, okay.
Right. Thank you, Blaine.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Oh, boy. Today has been, and we, all right, I'm ready. Give it to me.
Say hello to John.
John, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. Hey, I've got a 2006 Honda Accent 4.1 liter engine. It's my daughter's car. I don't know what the mileage is on it. It had just put in a new alternator, and since that's been put in, it is not running properly. It's running intermittently. It threw no codes, but it will not jump start with the wires on the battery or the wires off of the battery. The dash lights will not turn on when you go to ignite your key switch. I'm going through my notes here real quick. And I moved some wires around underneath. It ran for a couple of days, stopped, gave her nothing. She went in yesterday, turned it on, it ran. Today, it's not doing anything at all. What might I look for, please?
This all started with a battery, quote-unquote, area issue, right?
Yeah, I'm guess so, yeah, because okay. It went from battery to alternator. Battery okay. is only 6 months old, and it's been bench-tested also, and it's fine.
Okay. I'm quite sure that someone, if you look around the positive and negative areas of the battery, I'm quite sure that you're going to find some... There's going to be multiple cables that go to the positive side. The negative probably has two cables, a big fat one that goes directly to the motor, and then it's going to have another one that's going to go to the fender well.
2 minutes.
So there'll be two grounds. Because the motor sits in rubber, we need to ground the motor, but we also need to ground the car. As far as the positive is concerned, your Honda is well known for having all kinds of different legs and harnesses and connectors and wires that go to the positive side. So if I was working on that car, the very first place I'd go is there. You have all the symptoms of an intermittent feed to like the ignition switch, which means nothing happens when you hit the key, nothing happens, or to a, what we call a main circuit, like the headlights that don't need the key switch. And so sometimes the headlights work and sometimes they don't. But the symptoms that you give suggest to me that, and it started with a battery and an alternator, and you're never going to jump start the car by using just the cables on the Honda. That never works. So I'm going to eliminate that from my database because there's nothing there for me. But in the case of this, I'm quite sure the positive cable is missing one wire, or it's got a connection problem, or it's all, you know, gummed up or dirty or something like that. And on a 1 to 10 scale, this is really about a 3. And I would imagine that you'd probably get out of there for less than $50 if they just fixed the problem, as opposed to replacing the $150 cable and all the junctions off of it. So most of us will just fix the problem as opposed to selling you the entire cable. But that's what I do. If you want to shop in your area to look at, go to MarkSalem.com and look at my best shops list. And all those guys are gray-haired guys, and they all know what they're doing. And this, like I say, on a 1 to 10 scale, this is a 3. It's not a difficult thing to do. Anyway, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. The lines are wide open. You got 1 in 5 chance, 602-508-0960. We're going to come back with another hour. Well, welcome back, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock, you have no idea what the last 8 or 9 minutes has been. My phone has just blown up, but I do have some information. On the gentleman with the Yamaha motorcycle, Edward, I've had a couple of friends call me and say, nobody wants to do that. You need to take it to a motorcycle shop because we think it's a bucket and shim adjustment. So there's this bucket, and we put different thickness shims in there, and so someone has to have a wide variety of shims in order to adjust the valves on your motorcycle. And a shop that could do it would have to just go to the motorcycle shop and buy shims all the time. The other thing is if you don't have any noise and you don't have any backfiring, any rattle, any clatter up at the valve train on your motorcycle, then you don't need a valve adjustment, and that's a good point. So anyway, let me tell you about a shop, Blackwell Automotive, 40th Street in Glendale, or Greenway. 40th Street in Greenway handles the entire northeast portion of the valley. You just can't find anybody else up there that meets my particular standards. So Blackwell, he's a good guy. He knows old cars and new cars. He knows diesels. He does alignments and front end work. He does check engine lights and all that kind of stuff. And I've known him for 20 years or more. So he's kind of up in that area. Kurtz is at I-17 in Bell. He's on the northeast corner. He's been around since 1987. He does gas and diesel. He has ASE certified technicians, and a couple of them are masters. So if you're near I-17 in Bell, I'd like you to consider Kurtz if you don't already have a good shop. If you've got a good shop, stay there. On the other hand, if you're going to be up in the area of Blackwells into the North Scottsdale area, Northeast Scottsdale area, then Blackwells is a good place. Okay, Richard first. Richard, you're first. How can I help you?
Actually, Mark, Richard dropped, so let's go to Sean.
Okay, Sean, you're going to be first then because Richard's gone, so how can I help you?
Hey, Mark, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 2000 Chevy Astro van, and it's got about 260,000 miles on it. And as of right now, it's running fine. And my question is, I really like it. I use it as a cargo van. It holds a ton of stuff, and it fits in my garage. But my question is, I'd really like to drive it as long as I can, and I'm trying to decide the best way to do that. Should I consider changing the head gasket before it fails, or would that be a waste of money because I'll have to replace the motor eventually anyway? And am I going to have, how much longer am I going to be able to get parts? I mean, it's 22 years old.
Okay.
And I've had, you know, vehicles in the past I've had to get rid of because they just couldn't get parts for them.
Okay.
And so that's basically it. I'd like to drive it as long as I can, and I'm wondering how long I can drive it and what's the best way to do that.
Okay. You just continue to do what you've been doing. You fix it when it's broken. You don't look into the future. You don't try to second guess its life. You don't ever take it apart unless you're going after something to fix it. I know a lot about a 2000 Astro van because we've had many Astro vans since 1996, and those are the ones we use to take our customers home. Now, your 260 is a huge number, but ours, we put a motor in ours at 380.
Really? Wow. Okay.
And you've got the little 4.2 liter V6 probably in it. And and all I'm telling you is just fix things as they come and go. That's it. So if you got an oil leak, go ahead and fix it. If as long as it's idling good, you pass emissions and the check engine light is not on, you are okay. So to do anything, if you were, it's going to die for one of two things. Number one, it's going to overheat and just take the motor with it, and getting another motor is no problem. Sticking it in is no problem. It's no big deal. It's going to die because if you overheat it, and if you can not overheat it, then you're money ahead. And number two, or it's going to start leaking oil profusely or drinking oil profusely because it's got some broken rings on it or it's got something wrong with it. And so when you start looking like a fog machine driving down the road and the blue cloud behind you, it goes from Indian School to Camelback and the police are chasing you, but they can't find you. That's the time you're going to have to decide what you're going to do. But don't do anything that, and I say this with a smile on my face, there's nothing you can do to make that motor love you more. Just maintain it and fix things that are broken. But that's a great vehicle. We love those old Astro vans. Okay?
Yeah, I like it too. That's wonderful. Okay, great. Right. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Sean. Stefan, you're up next. How can I help you?
Okay, short questions. Actually, you already answered my first one. I was trying to get the name of the shop at Bell and 17th. You got that, Kurtz.
Okay.
As far as a vehicle, it needs several things done. Your shop is down by my work, and Kurtz is closer to the house. Which one would be better as far as timeline to be able to get several mechanical things taken care of as far as your workload?
Both of us are in the same boat right now. As a matter of fact, just about every shop owner I know is up to his ears in alligators. I can tell you that there's a lot of similarities between my shop and Kurt's. Number one, Kurt and I are about the same age. Kurt and I have the same background. Kurt and I have no patience for stupid technicians. and we are the Hitler of our shop, and we don't listen to anybody else's suggestions, and we all are on the same page, and that's take care of the customer's need. Don't sell them something they don't need, they don't want. We don't do flushing. We don't flush nothing unless it's got black fluid in it. We don't flush to make your car love you more and more. And I have my son and my daughter running the shop, and he has Eric running the shop. And Eric and Alan, my son and Eric, are two of the best young men I know. And so we're very close, and it's really a matter of who you can get in first. That's really the issue. And so I would probably let that be your, have you ever been in our shop before?
I've been to your shop. I haven't had any work done yet.
Okay. I know that we haven't shut down new customer numbers yet. We were thinking about that, but we chickened out. So if you come in and you have a customer number, you're in, no problem. But if you come in and you don't have a customer number, politely as we can say, we just can't handle the volume. But I don't know where we're at, so just call the shop and ask. But Kurtz, I'm going to tell you, Kurtz is probably days, if not a week behind, just like we are.
Okay, but if I want to get a customer number, then I might think about getting into your shop and see what and just be patient.
You'll get one when you walk in the door and make an appointment, and you go in, and they say, what's your name? And you say, I'm not in your database, and they'll say, okay, and then you get a customer number. So they're not going to ask you when you make an appointment if you have a customer number. They'll make one there. Your appointment puts you in line. All righty?
Okay, I get two other small questions. On a 2005 Hyundai Tiburon, is there I don't have my manual. Is there a valve adjustment that's generally required somewhere along the road? I'm at 106,000.
Okay, normally not. Normally not.
Okay.
And I want you to know that I won't do a valve adjustment on anything unless I've got a noise that goes with it. That's it.
I'm just hearing a little more rattling at the start of the engine.
Okay, and that's a clatter, and you said you had 200 and how many thousand miles on it?
106.
Okay, 106. That's kind of normal. You've been around the earth four times. So you've been around the equator four times at 100,000. So it's a little normal for it to have a little clatter and then go away. That's good news because, number one, the oil pressure is taking care of the clatter. Number two, we expect that at 100,000 miles. And here's what you could do if you wanted to. This would be really valuable, is pull in, next time you have your oil changed, tell them to save some oil and send it down into a laboratory on the internet and have them do an oil analysis. Now, the first one's not going to do us any good, but the second one will. So 3,000, 8,000, 10,000 miles later, we do another one. You do another one. Tell us to hang on to your oil. Tell Kurtz to hang on to your oil. Then you send that in. And now they go, hey, all the metal that was in the first is in the second, and there's no growth. And so that's when you stick your hand in the air and go, yahoo. You know what I mean? All the brass, okay, all great. The copper, all the metal hasn't grown any. So if we got something coming apart inside the motor, they're going to say, oh, boy, you got a problem here, da, da, da. But as long as the two oil tests have the same metal content and there's no growth, then there's no problem. There's no problem.
Okay, good. One last quick question. Is there a financial benefit to having a lot of known issues taken care of at the same time as far as mechanical?
All we want is symptoms. Yeah, just symptoms. I mean, Kurtz, I can speak for them too. Just tell us what's going on and say, this is my concern, and we all write it down, and then we answer your concern. In that concern that you got a little bit of a valve clatter that goes away pretty quick in the morning, I'm going to tell you the same thing, and so is Kurtz. That's a waste of your money. Let's just move on.
Okay. Well, there's a question about other things, valve cover gaskets, control arm, rubber and CV joint.
Okay, let's do that right now. Valve cover gaskets, we might want to put a short wrench. I'm talking about a 3-inch wrench on an extension. We don't want a 2-foot breaker bar because we don't want the technicians just hammering those gaskets
over
down.
Torque. Yeah.
So we just right. take a small little ratchet and tighten them all up.
Okay. Just 2 minutes.
And we look for oil leaks, and if there is no oil leaks, we're not going to touch it. And so it's that okay. kind of a look. You just say, look at this, because I want to tell you something. Nobody's ever been towed in because they've had valve cover gaskets leaking unless there's a hole in the valve cover, and okay. and that's half the piston. So there's a lot of stuff that's kind of scary and spooky, but then in reality, it's just no big deal. And the very first hint of a valve cover gasket is a little bit of wisp of blue smoke from the crack of the hood when you shut it off and you walk in the house and you're carrying your groceries. You look behind you and you got a little wisp of blue smoke coming out. Okay, got a valve cover gasket leaking. So a lot of that stuff is just kind of, we deal with it when we have to. So, all right, got to run. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your kind words. And like I said, Kurtz is a great place. You already know that. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. And, Gil, do we have anybody in queue?
We actually have Richard.
Richard, I'm going to take you. I might just take your question and then take a break, but go ahead and let's talk about your problem first.
I have a 1994 GMC truck Sierra, and I think I have a transmission leakage because the transmission comes out sometimes, the oil, and then it sits there. You don't have any transmission. You can't even see anything on the ground. Then, whoosh, it comes down and out on the ground. I want to know if anywhere I can get that transmission fixed.
Okay.
Covered.
Okay, well, as long as you can show them and show them what you're talking about, tell them this is what happens and this is what goes on. Let me just ask you a question. Obviously, you think you've got a transmission fluid system problem. Do you have any kind of a huge leak underneath the vehicle where you park it?
Yes, but that only happens occasionally. And then Well, here's what happened. I bought the vehicle and I drove it for a couple of weeks. I only went over 100 miles and then I came home, parked it in the drive and everything was fine. And then it dumped on me. It dumped all over.
Okay, so stop, please, stop. Is the oil brown, black, red, pink, maroon? What color is the oil on the driveway floor?
Red.
Okay. Red. I just want to make sure it's transmission. That's all. I just want to make sure. So the best thing I would do is I'd find a shop and I would take it to them, make an appointment, take it to them, park it in their driveway the night before, and just put a note on the steering wheel with a piece of tape, because you're going to do the night drop your keys off, and you're just going to say, it's in here for an oil leak. Please, when you back it up, take a minute and look at the oil that's on the ground. We love those okay. kinds of notes. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think there's any oil in your car.
Yeah.
I have to have it totally up there. Okay. I want to tow it because there's no transmission oil. I think it's all drained out.
Okay. All right. Well, if it drained all the transmission oil out, the oil slick would be 8 feet end to end and maybe 4 feet wide. Because the transmission holds between probably 6 and 10 quarts of oil. And when you pour that out on the ground, it's a pretty big stain. So I'm not quite sure. But what the problem here is forget the leak, forget all that other stuff. You have something that when you put it into gear, it doesn't move. And if that's the case, then that's what we go for. Maybe the linkage fell apart on it. Maybe the linkage, even though you're putting it in drive, maybe the linkage isn't putting the transmission in drive. There's all those moving parts. But anyway, got to run, Richard. Thank you very much, and we'll be right back. Push a couple buttons here to make sure that everything is working on my end. 22 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. The lines are open, 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. Let me touch on a couple of things that I think will be valuable to you. There's so many different ideas between even shops about what kind of oils you should use and when you should change your oil and on and on and on. But I want to tell you that the reason there's a problem is because many of the cars don't even agree. Chevy doesn't agree with Ford. Ford's different than Chrysler. Chrysler's different than Honda. And Toyota looks like, somebody from outer space. The idea is that your owner's manual is written for your car by the people that made your car. And the default is always the owner's manual. If it says that you change your transmission oil at 100,000 miles and it says to do the filter at the same time, then that's what you need to do. If you run across a shop that tells you that wasn't written for Arizona and you need to change your fluid every 50,000 miles, I would suggest to you that they have their interests in front of yours. Because the manual's written for that car in all 50 states plus anywhere else in the world it can possibly be driven. And so when you just do the United States, there's no such thing. And if you want to have fun with someone who's going to say that, you say, well, you know, why don't you order me an Arizona manual for my Toyota? and we'll look and see what it says. Because there's no such thing. So you can see that our industry has some people in it that are real self-serving that have decided to puff their chest out and tell you this is what you should do, which is diametrically different and opposite and 180 degrees from what the owner's manual says. Now, here's the hitch and the giddy-up. There's three kinds of oils. There's regular oil, which is what our parents were born and raised on. Then we have a semi-synthetic and a synthetic. Each one of those changes the oil change interval to some extent, but your owner's manual will tell you which one you want. It will describe which one you can use. For instance, if it costs a conventional oil, which is a cheap $35 oil change, then if you want, that's a 3 to 5,000 mile interval. But maybe you say, you know what, if I can go to 7,500 mile interval, then I can drive the whole year. Okay, well, we'll put a semi-synthetic in there because conventional is the bottom of the chart. Semi-synthetic is kind of in the middle, and a full synthetic is the big dog with the big heavy protection package. It actually, forget that protection package. That's a stupid thing for me to say. It's just an oil that will last far longer than conventional and semi-synthetic. And oftentimes on a synthetic oil, your interchange can be 10 to 15,000 miles. That's a real benefit for folks that drive that kind of mileage a year. Then I say to them, if they're my customers, bring it in April, May. We'll change your oil. You're going to go through the summer with fresh oil, and I'll see you next year, April or May, or at 15,000 miles or so. So that's kind of how it all works out. There's going to be some moving parts with your owner's manual, and transmission services is a good example. Most owner's manuals don't talk about a transmission dropping the pan on the transmission and replacing the filter. Here's why. When you drop the pan, you lose about 3 quarts of oil. So You dump the pan out. You clean up the metal inside of it, which is just powdered metal. It's no big deal. There's no big pieces of gear or anything like that in there. You put a new filter up, and you put a new gasket on it. You put the pan up, zit, 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 and we're done. Now, you're going to be about 3 quarts low. Now, the transmission may hold 10. You're going to be about 3 quarts low, so you're going to add 3 quarts of new transmission. There's a lot of people out there that believe that when you put high detergent brand new oil in, that it's going to wash the transmission clean and cause it to fail. That's never been true. That's never been true. There's no such thing as scrubbing bubbles in your oil. The detergent in your oil does this. The detergent holds this speck of caca in suspension. So the next time that little droplet of oil goes through the filter takes out the little piece. That's it. So instead of the small piece of trash floating to the bottom and being at the bottom of your oil pan, which there's going to still be a bunch of that, it just holds the dirt in suspension. So the next time that area of oil goes through the filter can filter out the trash. So when we talk about detergents, we're talking about holding the trash in suspension. It's not scrubbing bubbles. It's just something that helps keep the oil has an additive that holds trash in suspension. So the next time it goes through the filter, that's how it works. So those are the kinds of things that shops will vary on. And oftentimes they will say to you, well, you can't do that in Arizona because that manual's not written for Arizona. You need to take that with a grain of salt as far as I'm concerned. And I want to tell you something. Nothing would light my tail end on fire with both back pockets blazing flames if I heard one of my staff say that. And Kurt's the same way, and virtually all the other guys on our group together feel the same way. The manual is the Bible for your car, so we'll stick pretty close to the manual and what it tells us to do. It'll tell you at 100,000 miles to do the spark plugs. You can do them at 50 if you want, but you still need to do them at 100. So you got 50 on them. Why are you taking them out at 50? Why don't you run them to 100 and then put in another 100 and run them to 100? So and the spark plug for 100,000 miles is quite different than the spark plug that's going to be changed at 25. There's a difference in price, a difference in quality. Platinum, titanium, all kinds of fancy words that go along. So that's how it works. Who's on hold, Gil?
Don.
Don, good morning. How can I help you?
Hey, brother from another mother. How you been?
Hey, I'm good. I'm trying to behave myself. And
that's no fun. It's no fun.
I know.
Hey, in our fleet, we've got a 13 Dodge that needs a spring in the you know what I mean? A clutch spring.
The pressure plate?
No. In the steering wheel.
1 minute.
The clock spring.
Clock spring, yes. I'm sorry.
All right, now see, if you use the right word, then I'll get it. Now,
yeah,
you,
I understand.
I'm teasing you. Okay, so
anyway,
why don't you just put it in?
Well, it's on order. $400 from Bill Luke.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm gonna do something for you that I'm not gonna do for anybody else.
It's not mine. It's the company truck.
I understand, but we have been friends for 20 or 30 or 40 years.
Yeah.
And this is what I'm going to offer you. If you will send me the specific data or even the part number, the Dodge part number, I'll have our parts department look and see if they can find it. And let me tell you why. I'm very proud of our parts department. They find stuff no one else can find, and here's how they do it most of the time. They'll take that part number, and they'll find other part numbers of the same part in different boxes. So they might find that clock spring in BorgWarner. They might find that clock spring in Denso. So they're really good with taking a part number and then crossing it into a variety of other manufacturers' boxes. And I would have them do that for you. Because I know you drive a tow truck, and I know your company, and I'm willing to help you under those circumstances.
It's not a part yet either, so.
Okay, and that's good, too. That's good, too. So you have an airbag light on?
Airbag light. No, clutch spring. and then the ABS light comes on, but I don't have any controls on the steering wheel for the radio or cruise control or anything else.
Okay, all right, and that's the clock spring. Now, you're
take a break, Mark.
Oh, and we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
All about that
33 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock, and 33 minutes means I missed my mark at 30. Gil was so nice. He said, are you going to take a break this century, in my ears? And I said, looked at the clock, and I'm like 3 minutes too late. So I apologize to Gil for making a big mess, but he's got magical fingers, and he's got this computer that he can move stuff around and squeeze this up and move this in and make me still look like a hero. Don, first of all, let me just talk about a clock spring for everybody else. Folks, your steering wheel is moving all the time, and we have a lot of controls on there that need to be hardwired to the rest of the car. So the clock spring is this device that has this little ribbon inside that has a whole bunch of wires in the ribbon for your horn, your cruise control, all this kind of stuff. I'm talking to them. Hang on just a minute. I'm talking to everybody else because you and I know what it is, but I'm going to describe it. So all of these wires have to move with the steering wheel, and after you drive a tow truck for 400 million miles, then the tape is going to break and you lose all your controls. But Don, one thing I want you to do, though, is just get an exploded drawing of that clock spring, and there's a power and a ground to that thing, and make sure that you know by the drawing where the power and ground go. Because it's not unlikely that we're going to find that we don't have 12 volts. We go to 12 volts. We feed it 12 volts. And then all of a sudden everything starts working. So our source of power is the problem. And that happens to be a fuse that's hidden behind the glove box that no one's ever knew was there. So I'm just saying to you that that's something. But you just email me the information. Year, make, and model, VIN number of the truck. Jeff will make sure that, doggone sure, that that's the right number. And then we'll do our best to see if we can find that switch. Every once in a while we hit a home run, but you and I go back a long ways, and I'm happy to do that for you. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Number in my Facebook thing?
It's mark at marksalem.com.
Oh, you want to do it that way? Okay.
Yeah, do that. Okay. Because I'm going to forward your message to Jeff that way, and so he gets, and I don't have to transcribe your VIN number twice. So,
okay.
Anyway,
thank you.
Thank you, Don. You bet. Strictly Diesel Service and Repair, and it's owned and operated by Nate, is one of my favorite shops because he's up north. First of all, he's at I-17 and Pinnacle Peak Road, and when it comes to Chevy, Dodge, and Ford diesel trucks, Nate's the king. Nate does really good work. He knows what he's talking about, and when you meet him, and I say this with a smile on my face, but it's the truth, he's exactly the kind of young man you hope your daughter's going to bring home. He's honest, dependable. He's got a nice, firm handshake. He's got hands the size of tennis rackets, but he just knows. And he's so truthful and honest about, listen, I don't know what's wrong with your car, but I know I can figure it out, and this is what we're going to do, and this is what it's going to cost you. And I heard him say this, and I thought it was impressive as heck. This may be one of those things that costs you $150 to find it and $20 to fix it. But it could also be $120 to find it and $500 or more to fix it. And I like that. I like that experience coming through. So Nate is Strictly Diesel is a really, really good guy. And we got another caller, and who might that be?
Say hello to Harry.
Harry, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Hey, I heard you talking about the premium fuel compared to the regular fuel, and you kind of touched a little bit on diesel, but you didn't say too much. I know diesels have a cetane rating instead of an octane. When I used to have a diesel and towed a trailer, and you'd hit the Rockies and some of the truck places you'd pull in, they'd have and I can't remember if it was a higher or lower cetane rating for a lot of the truckers to, you know, make it up to, you know, the steeper grades.
Right, right.
You ever use that, or do you?
When we went into electronics, Harry, when we start metering the amount of fuel being delivered, both gas and diesel, into the cylinders, and we're going to let the computer control the spark or the combustion in a gas, but as you well know, we're going to compress the air and diesel fuel and cause an explosion, and the timing of the injector, when it sprays in and so forth and so on, we don't really need a cetane rating other than in the really cold climates. So when you get up in that north, east and west, 70 east and west to 80 east and west and 90 east and west, you're probably going to find some winter blends of fuel. But we can control the amount of power. We can control the explosion by controlling the fuel and the air. And by doing that, then we don't really need, and there's no real benefit to putting a premium in a car with an oxygen sensor in a computer controlled vehicle. There is no, as soon as it rattles, and long before the driver can hear it, the computer's going to start retarding the timing anyway. So in the older cars, premium makes a difference. But if it's got electronic controls and the oxygen sensor is the key, if it has an oxygen sensor on it, then you can put premium in there and you'll never know the difference.
So actually, the winter blend and the summer blend are two different ones. Does that have to do with suntan raining too?
I think
so.
No, I think so. I'm not a real good diesel guy, but I think so. Because I've been in those environments where I've heard truckers on CB radios, and I'm in a diesel motor home, and I've heard them talk about that. And so that's kind of the YouTube of the world now today. But cetane has always been its ability to explode in different temperatures. And obviously, a truck that's sitting there at 0 degrees trying to start, and of course it's got glow plugs, is going to start a little bit better if our diesel has a little bit more cetane, alcohol, or some other flammable compound to help us light that diesel gas that really is nothing more than peanut butter when it's cold.
So the better rating on the cetane burns faster instead of like the octane burns a little slower in your premium.
If you were going to do it that way, I don't know that that's a good analogy, but I understand what you're saying, and I think you're right.
Well, I know the nozzles they have for those are those giant ones that usually don't fit into your regular tanks on, you know, most trucks or, you know, whatever. If you got, you know, another tank, you know,
well,
which I had in a bed of mine, I put it in, but those are, and they'll put 5 gallons for 10 seconds in a hurry.
Yeah. I got to run, Harry. I got to break. But yes, you're right. And I'll have one comment on the other side of now. Well, welcome back, everybody. 44 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. And when we talk about history stuff, what's important is to understand why it's important to think about that. And I'll give you an example. Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing in Mesa is run and operated by Brian Vivian and his wife Thelma, who's a Thompson. Now, the Vivian family and the Thompson family go back to the 50s and 60s in Mesa because they owned gas stations. The Thompsons hung around the Shell brand a little bit, and the Vivians hung around the Union 76 brand a little bit. So one of the Vivians had the Union 76 gas station at Country Club and University. And then one of the Thompsons had Gilbert and Apache Boulevard, the Shell station there, and they had a variety of other facilities as well as car repair shops. Well, Brian and Thelma were married, so they married up these two families that have been in the gas station business, and I make fun of Brian and Thelma in this respect. These kids know what it's like to sit down at dinner and have the gas and have a smell of gas in the room because of their dad. These kids, and I say kids, they're young adults. Brian and Thelma have picked up cigarette butts with a stupid little broom and a dustpan when they were younger at the gas stations their parents ran. And I know that because my kids did that in the gas station business of the 70s. I go back into the gas station business in 1968. When I was in high school, I started working at Ken's Broadway Shell at Broadway and Priest in Tempe. Ken, who's passed, Ken taught me a lot. Now, my mother would say that Ken taught me mostly good things and a few bad things, and I would agree with my mother because Ken was kind of ornery. But he taught me how to fix a tire. He taught me how to rotate a tire. He taught me how to use an air gun. He taught me how to change oil. He taught me how to properly check everything under the hood, and he never taught me anything to scam or defraud anybody out of a service or tell them they needed something when they really didn't need anything. He never did any of that. So I was blessed because he did that for me for, 5-6 years. The idea is that we all came from those old gas station days. And keep in mind, back then, you had an owner's manual, and pretty much everything was based on 3,000-mile oil change intervals. Today, it's different. It can be up to 15,000-mile oil change intervals. But what we do when we change your oil doesn't change. It doesn't change. No matter what car you have, when we change your oil, we have a responsibility to look the car over for problems that exist right now. Our industry is not capable of knowing what's going to happen day after tomorrow. We don't have a crystal ball. We don't have a way of looking into the future. All we can look at is now. So during an oil change, we're going to change your oil and your filter. We're going to make sure that the drain plug's tight and that the oil filter didn't leak. And we're also going to make sure that we didn't leave the gasket up in the oil filter housing, because that's going to cause a problem. So when you take the oil filter off, you look at it, the gasket's on the filter can, you dump it into the drain bucket where you're going to drain the filter of the old oil. So it's important to do that, because those of you guys that are out there that are my age, you understand that if you double gasket that oil filter, that thing will start spraying oil like some kind of a huge oil derrick with a broken pipe, and you'll be driving down the road, and the next thing you know, you'll be spraying oil all over the road, and there'll be blue smoke everywhere because somebody didn't get the gasket off the first filter, and they put two gaskets on top of one another, and the oil pressure will blow them out. So those are the things that happen a lot, but that's where me and many, many of the shop owners today that are my age, that's where we got hooked into this industry. But we still, on an oil change, we're supposed to check your tires and inflate them appropriately, and we all use the numbers that are on the door sill of the driver's door. So there's a sticker there that tells us what the inflation numbers should be, and we're all going to use those numbers. Now, some of us will go to the maximum inflation of the tire. For instance, you might have a tire that has a maximum inflation of 35 pounds. The door sticker says that you could put 32 in here. Here's the thought process. 35 is the most you can put in that tire. 32 is what it needs to handle the load carried by that tire. There's nothing wrong with going from 32 to 35 at all. Here's the deal. 35 is the maximum inflation of the tire, so you're not going to go past that. But at 35, I want you to bring you back to the school days when you used to ride your bike. When you rode your bike to the gas station and the tires were half flat, it took a lot of effort. When you got there and you aired up your tires and you rode home, it was like driving a Stingray. All of a sudden, you're just flying down the road because the tires are fully inflated. There's nothing wrong with inflating your tires to the maximum inflation that's written on the side of the tire. It's okay. Some people won't like the ride, and they may go from 35 back to 32. That's okay. Most people, probably 95% of the people, would never know the difference, but it's the difference of better fuel economy, and the tire will run slightly cooler with a higher inflation than it does with a lower inflation. Slightly cooler. The tire may wear a little bit more of the center, but typically that doesn't happen, especially when you're talking about 3 or 4 or 5 pounds of different inflation, going from a 30 to a 35 or a 32 to a 37, something like that. You're not going to see tire wear. So there's a benefit. For me, I like to air up the tires to maximum inflation on everything we own, because if somebody's driving it and they kiss a curb, there's a good chance they're not going to cut the tire. The tire is going to hit the curb and bounce off. I also like the idea that the vehicle has fully inflated tires, so I get better fuel economy. Just like riding a bicycle. Riding a bicycle with your tires half flat takes a lot of effort. After you air up all your tires, it's like a brand new Corvette. So there's lots of benefits. In addition to that, a tire that's underinflated, carrying a heavy load, will heat up rather quickly. The glue will come apart about 200 degrees, and that tire is going to blow up. So if I air them up to the maximum inflation, that rarely happens. Now, it could be that the tire picked up the nail, then slowly the inflation dropped down, and then sooner or later the tire is going to overheat and blow up. But there's so many symptoms of that tire having a problem. There's so many symptoms of a sick tire that it's difficult for you not to know that. So there's going to be a noise associated with an underinflated tire when you turn. There's going to be a difference in how the car handles when you turn left and right, and when you make a sweeping right turn to get on or off the ramp out on the freeway. And there's going to be a, you're going to be able to see a difference as well if you walk around the car and just look at all four tires, compare one to all of them to one another. You can clearly see a tire that's inflated improperly, or perhaps, you know, sitting there at 20 pounds when it needs to be at 35. And then we also have different kinds of oils for different kinds of service. So we have a 3,000-mile oil, and then we have one that goes from 3 to 5, and then we have one that goes, that's a conventional oil. That's the oil that we had in the 50s, and it's a good oil. There's nothing wrong with it. Then we have a semi-synthetic that goes from 5 to about 7,500. Then we got a synthetic that goes from 7,500 up to 15,000. So for me and for our cars, if we're going to go close to the 15,000 miles a year, that's the annual mileage on my wife's car, my daughter's car, my son's car, all my cars, then we're just going to put synthetic in it, and we're going to change the oil in April or May. So all of our cars go through this summer with fresh oil. Now, oil is backward compatible. You can put a brand new, high-performance, $20 a quart synthetic oil in your 55 Chevy. I don't care what you think or what you've been told, that is an acceptable change. Now, there may be some ramifications, but none of them are negative. But the idea is that you can take a newer oil, and I'm talking about the last 20 years, and put it in something in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s with no problem at all. You just have to make that conversion with respect to the oil change. You don't want to put a premium oil in your car and change it every 3,000 miles, because that's a waste of finite resources. So if you're going to change your oil every 3,000 miles, then use the cheap conventional oil. That's it. So if you want to, but if you drive 7,500 miles a year, then use a semi-synthetic and change your oil at the beginning of the summer every year. But for me, like on my truck, I do about 20,000 miles a year, so I'm changing my oil every 10 months. And when I get up to that point, I just have the oil changed. So those are the kinds of things. And I drive a Dodge diesel, and I can run that diesel with no problem, 7, 8, 9, 10,000 miles on an oil change. We've done some oil analysis, and it's fine. I'm not shedding any metal. I'm not causing myself any damage. It's not hurting anything, and I'm using a great, and the brand doesn't really mean anything, but I'm using a diesel-certified oil. So those are kind of things that we have to deal with when we're talking about your car. And many of us old guys, especially you widow ladies and ladies that are either widowed or divorced or whatever, you don't have a man in your life, it's not uncommon for them to come to us and say, am I doing everything I'm supposed to? And all I need to see is your maintenance records. That's really all. So you can do that to your shop as well, and they can look at them and say, well, you're changing your oil and your transmission twice a year. I don't think that's necessary. I think once a year is fine. So I would drop the pan, change the filter, and do that once a year. After all, Mrs. Jones, you got 40,000 miles in 5 years. It's not like you're driving the wheels off this car. Those are the kinds of conversations that we'd have. My son tells me to change the flush my cooling system every year. No, you're only doing 8,000 miles a year. I'd say every 2 years, and maybe even every 3 years, because the new coolants are so much different than the green ones we had in the 60s and the 70s. They're so much better. They protect so much better. They handle heat transfer so much better. They dissipate heat so much better. All of that kind of stuff happens. So those are the kinds of conversations you can have with your trusted car guy. You can also, and if you're going to do that, try to avoid Monday mornings and Friday afternoons for obvious reasons. It's not a good idea to go in and expect to have 100% of the head technician or the owner's time on a Monday morning and Friday afternoon, because that's when we're the busiest. But if you come in on Thursday at 10 o'clock in the morning, that's perfect, because by that time the day is situated. Everybody knows what they're doing. All the cars have been dispatched, and, you know, we're fixing cars. So those are the kinds of things. If you're looking for a good shop, you can stop at marksalem.com, which is my website, marksalem.com, and click on the best car repair shops. And here's my promise to you. If you have a problem with one of the shops, and you file a very nice, and don't use any bad words is what I'm talking about, a nice complaint like with the Better Business Bureau, if the Better Business Bureau gets involved in the dispute resolution process, then what will happen is that the shop will be involved. At the end of the day, the Better Business Bureau will tell the shop, do this, or it'll tell the customer, know we found for the shop. If the shop refuses to do what they've been told in this dispute resolution process at the Better Business Bureau, I will up to $5,000. So if the shop is told to make a refund of $311.50 and they refuse, two things happen. If that shop's on my list and I've been involved, the shop is off my list and I'll pay the money and we're done. That's how it works. Now, I've had one shop since 1988 test me on that. And ultimately, the consensus of the dispute resolution process was is he needed to give the customer back $1,000. And I said to him, I'm going to give him $1,000 if you don't, and then I'm taking you off the list. And he thought about that for a couple of days, and he sent me a check for $1,000, and I gave it to the customer. So I'm putting my hand up in the air and saying to you, this isn't just a list of all my friends, although they are my friends. This is a list of guys that know right from wrong, and they're going to take good care of customers that I send them. I don't get any money from them for your there. They don't send me a 1% of the ticket. They don't send me any money at all. We have an annual membership fee, and that's it. And it's in the very low hundreds of dollars. So it's nothing. It's just a matter of the number one question in 1988 when I first started with radio was, where's your shop? And so I decided to start sending people to shops that I knew that were good, and that's how we got to where we're at today. So my email is mark@marksalem.com, mark@marksalem.com. If you have any car questions or anything, please include your phone number, because oftentimes I'll have questions, and I'll see you next Saturday right here on 960.